910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. Syrian government falls. I'm Dave Packer. With allies consumed with their own conflict, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria has crumbled. Rebel forces now in control. President Biden speaking from the White House this afternoon.
The upshot for all this is, for the first time ever, neither Russia nor Iran nor Hezbollah could defend this abhorrent regime in Syria. And this is a direct result of the blows that Ukraine, Israel have delivered upon their own self-defense with unflagging support of the United States.
Watching this closely, families of Americans being held.
We are mindful that there are Americans in Syria, including those who reside there, as well as Austin Tice, who was taken captive more than 12 years ago. We remain committed to returning him to his family.
Russian media reporting that Assad and his family are now in Moscow. This is ABC News. In his first television interview since his electoral victory, President-elect Trump pressed his campaign promises and threats on NBC's Meet the Press.
You said President Biden, quote, that you're going to appoint a real special prosecutor to go after Joe Biden. You said that.
Where
during
did I say that?
The campaign.
Where?
You said that on Truth Social, June 12th, 2023. I will appoint a real special prosecutor to go after the most corrupt president in the history of the United States, Joe Biden, and the entire
Biden crime family.
Are you going to do that? Are you going to go after Joe Biden?
I'm really looking to make our country successful. I'm not looking to go back into the past. I'm looking to make our country successful.
Walt Disney's animated film Moana 2 remained at the tops of box office in its second weekend in theaters, bringing in another record haul. Film added $52 million, according to studio estimates today. That brings its domestic total to $300 million, surpassing the original Disney's apparent company of ABC News. Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
The Todd Allbush Show.
Cash Patel, who Trump has nominated to be the head of the FBI, saying he wants to basically shut down the main parts of the FBI. Bill Barr, MAGA Republican Attorney General to Donald Trump. Quote, the very idea of moving Patel into a role like this showed a shocking detachment from reality. Unquote. This is not the left calling out Patel. This is the right.
The Todd Allbush Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots.
Woot, woot!
And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Nearly one in five Wisconsin newspapers shut down in the last year. It paints a grim picture for the future of local news provided by journalists who live in the communities they serve. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
This year alone, 130 newspapers nationwide shut down, according to a report by the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. But amid an increasing climate of misinformation and media distrust among some Americans, the news outlets they say they trust the most are community newspapers. Professor Robert Aisen at the University of Wisconsin at Madison says in this polarized climate, where people choose to get their news matters.
It seems less and less that we're willing or able to see things that we may share in common. And that's exacerbated by a media ecosystem where we're not even getting the same information, where we're not even sharing the same basic set of facts.
A recent review of radio talk shows in Wisconsin found those with the largest audiences and the most advertising are led by conservative hosts who air the most misinformation. Aisen says leadership is a major influence in this trend.
When you look at public discourse and you look at public figures and you see examples of a disregard for truth or disregard for verifying stories or disregard for fair and kind of accurate representations, I think that those practices encourage more of the same practice.
Wisconsin Democrats proposed a package of bills earlier this year aimed at strengthening local journalism and its workforce. One bill would offer a tax credit for local newspaper subscriptions, but it didn't pass in the state Senate.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see a wintry mix of some light freezing drizzle and rain and snow today. High temperatures warming to the mid-30s. Southeast winds developing 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, wintry mix continues. Lows in the mid-20s.
Currently 35 degrees.
Dom Selvia.
Jess P.S., Dom's producer here. Next time, catch Dom and Jess back in the studio to chop up the news with our favorite FDR Democrat or socialist. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel. And I'm your host for this hour and also the next hour. This weekend, our weekly review, our analysis, our deliberation, our consideration of those most recent news items in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Delighted and honored that you have chosen to spend some portion of your weekend in conversation and communication with me about these and other issues. As always, on our weekend broadcast, we are also soliciting, encouraging, urging enthusiastically your inquiries and your comments, your questions about anything on our syllabus this weekend. We're taking your phone calls, as always, from the Civic Media stations and through our good listeners at 855-752-4842. That number once again is 855-752-4842. My terrific producer, Max, also reminds me that you can also be in touch with us by dropping a question or an inquiry into the Civic Media app and being in communication with us that way as well. Lots and lots of things to get to this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. Let's talk about our syllabus for this hour and also the next hour, engaging with you on important issues of our times. We're going to begin with one of the major stories of this past week, and that is pardons. Revisiting a subject that we have talked a lot about on this broadcast in past editions of it. This past week, of course, pardons back in the news. Why? Because the President of the United States of America announced and has indeed granted a pardon to his son, Hunter Biden, with respect to three different things. He has pardoned him not only with respect to the prosecution and conviction of him in Delaware for gun counts, but also for tax charges out in California, and then has identified a larger period of time that the pardon also covers. We're going to talk about exactly what that pardon is all about, why that was done. And then we're also going to talk about a much related story percolating up later in this past week that also relates to this constitutional power of the president. And that is this notion that right now inside the White House, inside the West Wing, perhaps among the staffs of the president himself, discussion about issuing blanket pardons, what are called preemptive pardons, to people who, and this anticipates our discussion, have not committed crimes, but nonetheless may be seeking some shielding from what may come in a future administration, that of Donald Trump. We're going to talk not only about those two major news stories, but also we're going to dive deep into what pardons are all about. We're going to talk about the Constitution of the United States of America. We're going to talk about the ways in which the United States Supreme Court has on at least two occasions told us an awful lot about what the authority of the president is when it comes to extending, granting pardons to individuals. I'm going to talk about a couple of specific cases in that area. We're going to answer some of your questions about, yes, indeed, the so-called reflexive pardon or pardoning oneself, whether that is a real thing out there. We're going to talk also about some of the history, a checkered history, admittedly, with respect to decisions by former chief executives to grant pardons to people. Identify some of those throughout time, going back to the time of the Civil War, talking about some of the more contemporary pardons that have been issued, including the pardons issued by Donald Trump in his last term, and other pardons, 25 of them already up until the time of the pardon of his son, pardons issued by President Joe Biden. All of that in connection with our responsibility to you, our commission to you, to be a friend of you when it comes to understanding the law, understanding the rule of law, the administration of justice, lots of civics this weekend in connection with federal pardons and what the Constitution does and does not say about them. And then, of course, as always, some commentary, not only about the Hunter Biden pardon, but also this growing focus on the possibility that the present chief executive, Joe Biden, might issue preemptive pardons. I'm going to talk a lot about why that is a very bad idea, not only legally, but also for the purposes of the rule of law generally in America. We'll get to all of that as a part of our discussion in this, the first hour of Amicus. Necessarily, we're going to spend some time this weekend talking, as we often do, about the United States Supreme Court. Just this past week, four different oral arguments. You can hear them. You can engage in that discussion, not directly, but being a part of it by virtue of listening to those oral arguments as they are going on live and then also recorded on the Supreme Court lines. You can listen to them and be a part of this process by which the Supreme Court questions the attorneys representing the parties before them. This past week, four cases. We're going to talk about two of them. One of them is a case determining whether or not the Food and Drug Administration can go forward and regulate vaping, e-cigarettes, lots of very interesting constitutional issues there, authority issues under the FCC, once again, an agency issue, whether or not the courts are going to be permitting an agency to exercise its assigned responsibilities by the United States Congress, a vaping case. Big news this past week coming out of the Supreme Court. And second, equally significant, likely one of the three or four major cases of this term, United States Supreme Court addressing for the first time in its history the issue of transgender rights and specifically the status of transgender youth, whether or not some states that have attempted legislatively to prevent the provision of medical care for transgender youth, whether that is constitutional. Does that run afoul of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment? Does that run afoul of parental rights when it comes to decisions made internal to a family? Those issues also on the docket of the United States Supreme Court just this past week. We're going to talk about that vaping case, that transgender case, and also give you a sense about what the status of the great number of cases, now up to about 47, pending before the Supreme Court right now. And then, well into our second hour here on Amicus Law Review, I'm going to discuss with you a couple of other significant issues in the area of administration of justice, in particular, the Justice Department, the intention by the president-elect to nominate Kash Patel as the next director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the nation's premier law enforcement entity. Kash Patel likely going to be nominated by the president-elect as our next director. We'll talk about who he is, where he comes from, as we did when we heard about the announcement by the president-elect that he was going to be nominating Pam Bondi to be the attorney general. The attorney general, of course, is the boss of the director of the FBI. The FBI, of course, an agency of the Department of Justice. the Cash Patel anticipated nomination, also raising concerns not only about his history, but about things he has said in connection with his plans for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We'll talk about that, offer some commentary about that particular anticipated nomination. And finally, some lessons as well for Americans and also for our incoming and even present president, although he doesn't have to hear this a whole lot, about the problems of authoritarianism and the challenges that one confronts when one oversteps in terms of the exercises of power from an executive branch. Yes, we're talking about South Korea and the hours during which South Korea was under martial law, imposed by the president for a brief period of time on Tuesday of this past week. The big story there, the big rule of law story there, that is a lesson for all of us here in America, is what the Korean population did in response to something that they did not want. This message that they sent almost immediately that they do not want their government to be imposing martial law, insisting that the government, through the Office of the Presidency, take that back, rescind that order, which, of course, was done not only legislatively, but also through the executive processes there. A huge, huge statement on the international stage, once again, this past week, about what people can do when they see their government doing things with which they do not concur. And an affirmation of the possibilities in all democratic republics, offer in all places on the face of the planet, when people see governments doing things that are plainly contrary to the basic commission, the basic contract between government and its people. The government serving its people and not in the reverse. A lesson to us about the things that we have in our power to do, to insist that our government that is here to serve us also does just that here in the United States of America. And yes, indeed, not necessarily secondarily, but maybe in a prime role, the lesson sent to people who would be authoritarians, would be despots, tyrants in the administration of their own governments, a lesson about how far they can and cannot go. Coming out of South Korea, all of that coming up in the second hour of our discussion, our engagement with you on the administration of justice, the rule of law, and all things related to those issues that do affect dramatically our lives and our livelihoods here in Wisconsin, throughout the United States of America. And so let us begin. Let us begin with our ambitious but achievable agenda, talking first and foremost about federal pardons. We begin, of course, with the Constitution of the United States of America, as we often do. It is Article 2. It's Section 2, Clause 1 of the U.S. Constitution. It provides, in very simple language, almost certainly written by James Madison. It is a part of the prime focus of Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, vesting in a president powers of mercy. And we'll get back to that in particular. It says this: the president shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. That's the language. That's the language of the United States Constitution. And there plainly is an awful lot of history behind this. Alexander Hamilton defended the pardon power in the Federalist Papers, particularly number 74, described the reasons for it, talked once again about the notion of establishing somewhere in government the idea that there would be one individual who can express and can convey through his, maybe one day her, actions a sense of mercy, a sense of forgiveness for past offenses against our community, and also do it in a way that is consistent with the law. As we continue our discussion more about pardons and wrapping that into the basic news stories of this past week, as Amicus, a law review, continues.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Ho ho, the holidays are here, and it's time to pick a present from the grown-up gift list with Civic Media's statewide text-to-win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win $100 cash, an overnight vacation at Chula Vista Resort, and be entered to win one of the grand prizes, a robot vacuum, new luggage, humidifier, espresso machine, and more on the grown-up gift list at civicmedia.us. Just download the Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 11, 1, and 4 for your chance to win starting Monday morning. Ho ho ho!
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbald Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this hour and also the next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, beginning our weekend, our weekly discussion of all things rule of law related by reviewing some basic civics about pardons, what our Constitution says, what the Supreme Court has said about the ways in which this unfettered power vested in the executive branch can and cannot be exercised by a president. Pardons granted by presidents from George Washington until Grover Cleveland's first term were actually handwritten by the president himself. And after typewriters came to be used for regular White House business, pardons were then prepared for the president by administrative staff, requiring only that the president sign them. Of course, today we have got a much more robust and much more specific process. It is anticipated. It is the regular mechanism, but not compelled by the Constitution, that applications for pardons, that is, people have been convicted of crimes and are seeking this mercy, this sense of removal of the other burdens imposed by virtue of a criminal conviction, seeking those things to be removed by a president, that they would make an application to an office inside the United States Department of Justice, also a part of the executive branch, plainly. That office is the Office of the Pardon Attorney. And in recent years, the Office of the Pardon Attorney, again staffed by civil servants, yes, attorneys and others, who are responsible for reviewing these many applications that, as you can well imagine, come in to the executive branch, come into the Department of Justice every single year, every single term, seeking pardons by the president. It is the responsibility of the Office of the Pardon Attorney to look at those. Typically, they have said, we're going to ask you to wait 5 years after your term of imprisonment or the sentence, the judgment against you has expired, and also then show us something about your life, something about the ways in which you have conducted yourself since the time of your conviction, maybe in prison, maybe outside of prison, some community involvement, something you have done in your own life to make amends, if you will, in a non-legal way, to show us that, in fact, this mercy, this sense of largesse that a president can extend to someone seeking a pardon is appropriately granted. And after the Office of the Pardon Attorney's staff looks at those, they make recommendations. They send those packages over to the White House for the president and his staff, also through the Office of the Legal Counsel over there, the president's lawyers there inside the White House itself. They then review them, and the president makes a final determination, sometimes saying yes and sometimes saying no. That process that I just described is what is contemplated and has been contemplated in recent years by all presidencies. Followed routinely? No. No, not at all. And there are times, plainly, when a president can, by virtue of the things that George Washington and all presidents through Grover Cleveland did, can simply issue a pardon based upon their own writing without going through that process. The Office of the Pardon Attorney, that system is not in the Constitution, but it is a way of ensuring that there is some sense of equanimity, some sense of justice when it comes to reviewing these applications and making certain that they are indeed representative of the kinds of things that a chief executive should do in extending this mercy, this sense of forgiveness legally for what you have done. That process, once again, not always followed and probably will not be followed in the future from time to time. But routinely and for most pardons, even in recent years, recent administrations, that has been the process. What else do we know about pardons and the ways in which they should be administered? This is a big one. In United States versus Wilson, an 1833 case, the Supreme Court said a pardon can be rejected by a convict. You can be rejected. You don't have to accept a pardon. Indeed, the language of the Constitution talks about granting it, but not necessarily requiring the person to accept it. And indeed, in 1915, in a case called Burdick, a very important case called Burdick, the United States Supreme Court said this: circumstances may be made to bring innocence under the penalties of law. If so brought, escape by, and here's the important language, by confession of guilt implied in the acceptance of a pardon may be rejected, preferring to be the victim of the law rather than its acknowledged transgressor, preferring death even to such certain infamy. Now, that's a lot of language. And yes, it's written in language that may sound a bit foreign to our ears today, 100 years later. But what the Supreme Court was saying in Wilson and then again in Burdick is, number one, that a pardon does not have to be accepted. And indeed, in ways that we'll talk about in connection with this recent story, that there is perhaps some inquiry, some movement inside the White House to grant pardons to people who have not committed crimes, that a pardon can, in fact, be rejected by them. People saying, no, I'm not accepting a pardon because I've committed no crime. And that's what the Supreme Court has affirmed in Wilson and Burdick. And secondarily, perhaps even primarily, the Supreme Court has said this, that when one does accept a pardon, one is accepting responsibility for the underlying criminal conduct. You are accepting the guilt that goes along with that grant of a pardon. Very famously, after Gerald Ford granted a pardon to Richard Nixon in 1974, he was criticized routinely, not only immediately, but throughout his presidency, even after he left the presidency, after losing the presidency to Jimmy Carter. He was routinely asked by many people, why did you left? Why did you let Richard Nixon off the hook? Why didn't you let him be prosecuted for the crimes that he committed in office? Why is it that you basically exonerated him, Mr. President, and let him go free? And Gerald Ford had in his pocket, according to not only people who were with him, but his own accounts, a copy of some of this language in Burdick versus United States, saying that no, when a pardon is imposed, including a pardon on Richard Nixon, the impact of that by its acceptance by the person, by the defendant, whether they've been charged, by the person who may not be a defendant, is an acceptance and acknowledgement of guilt. And so Gerald Ford would say, by doing that, yes, I lifted from Richard Nixon the requirement, the obligation to go through a criminal trial, but I also established in him the acknowledgement that he had committed crimes. And there were plainly many, most notably at the top of the list, obstruction of justice involving the Watergate matter. Many of the things that have come to be known, not only by virtue of great journalism back then, but reporting even since that time about the many crimes that Richard Nixon committed. And Gerald Ford's position was that under Burdick, Richard Nixon, although not convicted in the traditional sense, nonetheless acknowledged those crimes, or at least some of them, by virtue of accepting that pardon. Interesting to keep in mind as you think about future pardons that may be imposed and granted, not only by the present president, Joe Biden, but by Donald Trump as well. And we'll talk more about that. Fundamental notion that a pardon concludes with an understanding of the defendant, of the person who receives them, that he or she is guilty of some underlying conduct. And that conduct is criminal in nature. Here's the other big thing that comes out of the Supreme Court addressing the issue of pardons. And this comes out of a case called Ex Parte Garland in 1866. Plainly not the name of our present attorney general, a different Garland. The Supreme Court said this: the power conferred upon a president is unlimited, with the exception stated, and that exception, of course, is for impeachment. What the Supreme Court said is extends to every offense known to the law and may be exercised at any time after its commission, either before or after legal proceedings are taken. more about what Garland tells us in connection with pardons here on the broadcast as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
This is a special report from ABC News. Syrian government falls. I'm Dave Packer. With allies consumed with their own conflict, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria has crumbled. Rebel forces now in control. President Biden speaking from the White House this afternoon.
The upshot for all this is, for the first time ever, neither Russia nor Iran nor Hezbollah could defend this abhorrent regime in Syria. And this is a direct result of the blows that Ukraine, Israel, have delivered upon their own self-defense with unflagging support of the United States.
Watching this closely, families of Americans being held.
We are mindful that there are Americans in Syria, including those who reside there, as well as Austin Tice, who was taken captive more than 12 years ago. We remain committed to returning him to his family.
Russian media reporting that Assad and his family are now in Moscow. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska filling in for Mike Clemens with Civic Media Sports. Marquette defeated Wisconsin yesterday 88-74 in a matchup of ranked teams. It was the fifth time in history both schools were ranked when they played each other. The Badgers led by two at halftime, but nine second-half turnovers forced by the Golden Eagles led to a big comeback. Marquette head coach Shaka Smart got his first win over the Badgers in four tries.
It's a terrific game and awesome atmosphere. Really grateful for our fans. The way they lit up Fiserv today. This is what college basketball is all about. I'm really grateful for the fact that there's two great college basketball programs in this state and that we get to play every year.
Four Marquette players scored in double figures, and the Golden Eagles shot 50% in the win. Next up for 8-2 Wisconsin is number 19 Illinois on Tuesday. Marquette will face Dayton a week from Saturday. The Milwaukee Bucks will play this evening against the Brooklyn Nets. The Bucks are coming off of back-to-back losses. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cuska for Civic Media Sports.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see a wintry mix of some light freezing drizzle and rain and snow today. High temperatures warming to the mid-30s. Southeast winds developing 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, wintry mix continues. Lows in the mid-20s.
Currently 35 degrees.
It was time to make our own Christmas traditions. For years, we've been trekking to both sets of in-laws, both Christmas dinners. It was just too much. So this year, we started to look for a place to get together in Alexandria, Minnesota. Christmas lights that will light up our kids' faces. A new adventure. Create some wonder. It makes us wonder, why didn't we do this sooner?
Start planning your time together in the Lakes area. Explore your holiday getaway options at explorealex.com.
Hey there, folks. It's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and a tip about saving money when you are renting a car. So you know how you get to the rental counter and then they ask you if you want to prepay for gas so you don't have to bring the car back full? Well, I used to get sweaty in those moments as I wasn't sure what the right money choice was. Prepaying for gas at the rental counter? Not worth it. First off, rental companies often charge more per gallon on the prepay than local gas stations do at the pump. And even if they're about equal, fees or taxes on your rental can tip the scales against prepaying. And you'd have to return that car completely empty to get the full value of buying prepaid gas. Otherwise, you're just buying gas for Avis and Budget or whoever. Quick note, make sure you have time to refill the tank before you return the rental. If you don't prepay and you don't fill up, they are going to charge you like they have refilled that car with liquid gold. For more tips, head to workmoney.org. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
Earl Ingram.
Mr. Ben Wickler, he is running for the national DNC chair. The fundamental problem was the Democratic brand. Do you think that is the case more than the Harris campaign?
Core answer is yes. The Democratic brand, it's not what we necessarily do or say. It's what people have heard and internalized. And that, to me, is an argument for thinking about how and where we communicate, making sure we are present in places where people are thinking about stuff other than politics.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, he is featured in an article in the Cap Times, and he's the host of Nightlight. Across Civic Media, Pete Schwabba will be joining us. And, of course, this shouldn't be a thing. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review. Thank you so very much for joining me in this weekend's discussion of all things rule of law, including pardons in America historically and in our contemporary history, including two big news stories just this past week involving the exercise of the pardon authority under the Constitution. In a case called Ex Parte Garland, 1866, the United States Supreme Court, which doesn't often get an opportunity to review pardons, if at all, said this for that very reason, affirming that very notion that the power established by the Constitution for a president to extend pardons is virtually unlimited. The power is unlimited, the Supreme Court said, and the proceedings during the pendency of the criminal proceedings after conviction judgment, you can do it whenever you want. This power, they said, of the president is not subject to any other checks and balances, not subject to legislative control. Congress can neither limit the effect of the pardon nor exclude from its exercise any class of offenders. The benign prerogative of mercy reposed in the president cannot be fettered by any other legislative restrictions. Goes on to talk about how this is one of the few, if others are out there in the Constitution, maybe the only one power established in the executive branch that is unchecked. Case called Marbury versus Madison, and I suspect you all know. School children know this as well, basically establishing the authority of the Supreme Court to tell us what the law is. John Marshall, Chief Justice at that time, said the president is vested with certain important political powers for which he is to use his own discretion and is accountable, get this, only to his country in his political character and to his own conscience. Talking there about presidential powers generally, but also about the pardon power. Whatever opinion may be entertained of the manner in which executive discretion may be used, still there exists and can exist no power to control that discretion. The decision of the executive is conclusive. In other words, the lessons of those cases and to this day is power vested in a president to do this with no other check inside the government. The reason for it, again, according to Hamilton and others in the Federalist Papers, wanting to establish somewhere in government someone who can exercise without a check the sense of mercy and a sense of largesse imposed upon other people, accepted by them, to administer justice in appropriate circumstances. What has been the history? What has been the history of all of this? Well, we know about a number of pardons that go way back to George Washington and have been a part of our history for many, many years. President Andrew Johnson granted a full pardon and amnesty to all the former Confederates on Christmas Day in 1868, extending to all of those, he wrote, who directly or indirectly participated in the late insurrection or rebellion. He's describing, of course, the Civil War. 1971, President Richard Nixon pardoned Jimmy Hoffa. He, of course, was that notorious head of the Teamsters Union. Well, he was less than 5 years into a 13-year prison sentence for jury tampering and pension fraud. Richard Nixon himself, of course, as we already noted, was pardoned by Gerald Ford for all federal crimes Nixon committed or may have committed or taken part while he was president. Very, very broad. in the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter pardoned approximately 200,000 draft resistors to the Vietnam War on his first day in office in 1977. Those who were charged had violated the Military Selective Service Act between August of 1964 and March of 1973 by failing to register for the draft or leaving the country. Many of these regarded as the so-called deserters, if you will. A description that, again, many of them would not embrace, many of them going to Canada rather than to serve in the Vietnam War. Jimmy Carter granting those reprieves, those pardons in 1977. George H.W. Bush, who served as vice president under Ronald Reagan, pardoned the convictions of six fellow Reagan administration officials for their role in, remember this, the Iran-Contra affair. That included the defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, who is indicted for lying to Congress. Bush pardoned Weinberger before his trial, and others also in that group who faced probation or were yet to be sentenced. In a very notorious pardon, Bill Clinton, on his last day in office, pardoned Mark Rich. He was a billionaire. Remember him, who had been indicted for evading about $48 million of taxes and making illegal deals with Iran. Roger Clinton, who is the president's half-brother, was also pardoned by Bill Clinton in 2001. The younger Clinton, who was sentenced to 2 years in prison for possessing cocaine and drug trafficking in 1985, he served in prison a few years at the time of the pardon, but not his entire sentence. You may recall well that in 2017, Barack Obama commuted all but 4 months of the remaining prison term of Chelsea Manning, who was a former U.S. Army intelligence analyst who, we may recall, had been convicted of leaking military information to WikiLeaks. Remember that case? Obama's pardon basically came 7 years into Manning's 35-year prison sentence. President Donald Trump, during the course of his first term in office, pardoned a number of people. Yes, that's right, including Steve Bannon, his former White House chief strategist. In the last hours of his first term, while Bannon awaited trial on federal charges relating to defrauding donors in a fundraising campaign. Donald Trump also pardoned Paul Manafort. He was also a recipient of a pardon. He was a former Trump campaign chairman, you may recall well, convicted of tax and bank fraud, among others, in 2018. Donald Trump also commuted the sentence, pardoned Roger Stone at the end of his term, spared his longtime associate by commuting his 40-month prison sentence and later extending him a full pardon. Along the way, the former president, future president, also pardoned a fellow named Charles Kushner. Charles Kushner pardoned him. He, of course, is the father of Jared Kushner, who is not only senior advisor during the Trump administration, but also the now former and future president's son-in-law. Kushner himself found guilty for witness tampering, making false statements to the Federal Election Commission. He served 14 months of a 2-year prison term before the pardon. You know that Trump has since will be appointing Kushner to serve as the U.S. ambassador to France significantly along the way while pleading guilty for those offense conduct, pieces of conduct, his behavior for which he was pardoned. Kushner also admitted to paying a prostitute $25,000 to lure his brother-in-law to a New Jersey motel room and film them having sex, with the recording then being sent to the man's wife, Kushner's sister, to intimidate him as he cooperated with investigators who were investigating Kushner on all of these other things. At the time, New Jersey U.S. Attorney Chris Christie, of course, who went on to be the governor of New Jersey, identified this as one of the most heinous crimes that he had seen, not only that intimidation conduct, but also false tax claims, claiming over $1 million in charitable contributions, office expenses, about $200,000 to $500,000 in losses to the IRS. That is also the pardon given to Charles Kushner, presumably our future ambassador to France. And that leads us finally to the news of this past week, including the decision by the current president, Joe Biden, to grant a full reprieve, a full pardon to his son. And that, of course, his son, of course, is Hunter Biden. We know already that he was convicted in Delaware for those gun charges, indicating on the form that he was not an addict at the time, when indeed he was. At least that was a determination of the jury. And then he pled guilty to some tax charges out in California to bring all this to conclusion. Just this past week, the president, after telling us initially that he was not going to grant a pardon, said this. He said, "No reasonable person who looks at the facts of Hunter's cases can reach any other conclusion that Hunter was singled out only because he is my son, and that is wrong." He went on to say this: "There has been an effort to break Hunter, who has been 5.5 years sober, even in the face of unrelenting attacks and selective prosecution. In trying to break Hunter, they've tried to break me, and there's no reason to believe it will stop here. Enough is enough." And so that pardon, again, which the recipient of it, Hunter Biden, has accepted. He has been convicted. He is a convicted felon by virtue of the judgment entered against him in Delaware by a jury, and also by his own plea out there in California. There is no doubt that the particulars, as established by the Supreme Court, that someone who is receiving a pardon, accepting a pardon, is acknowledging guilt. Hunter Biden is doing just that. He has already been found guilty, adjudicated guilty. And now what that does is, of course, it takes off the calendar the sentencing hearings, both in Delaware and California, scheduled for this month. Sentencing hearings that probably would have resulted in Hunter Biden, under the federal sentencing guidelines, going to prison for as much as 3, maybe more years than that. Not a small sentence at all. Now, Hunter Biden, the recipient of that pardon from his father. Plainly not unprecedented. We already talked about the situations involving Charles Kushner and Roger Clinton, people in the extended families of a president. And we know as well that there have been many other kinds of pardons imposed by present and past presidents that have been controversial. I've identified many of those. This has been plainly a history of use most often by presidents who do this out of largesse and out of a sense of mercy, but nonetheless gathering a lot of attention when this is done. Anticipate that this present president, Joe Biden, will probably issue more pardons in the closing days of his term. Hunter Biden's is the 26th that he has granted over the period of his presidency. And those go way back to April 26th of 2022, a series of pardons imposed and granted on December 30th of 2022. Many of them, September 14th of 2023. You may remember a lot of these had to do both in September and April of 2024. Commuting the sentences, imposing and granting pardons for people involved in cocaine trafficking, drug violations, and many other things, as have other presidents. Now, the question, of course, is that kind of a pardon? Number one, is that a proper use by a president? And that is the debate, plainly, that is out there in the public domain. And this is one of those situations where, as we often say in this broadcast, reasonable people may have different views about this. The additional aspect that I will add, as have many other prosecutors, federal prosecutors who have commented about this, is it consistent with what Joe Biden has said? It is atypical. It's not unknown. It's not unprecedented for a defendant to be charged with the kinds of crimes, the tax offense, the paper offense involving the purchase of a gun by Hunter Biden. Those particular things are in the books. They are crimes, undeniably. Very unusual to prosecute those particular types of offense conduct, most often resolved either through an agency process, sometimes through deferred prosecutions, other ways of resolving them. And so, while this is not unprecedented, it is certainly atypical, giving some force to the president's statement that he was identified, that is his son, Hunter Biden, doing this because his last name is Biden. And in the end, as an awful lot of people have said, it is a power that the president has. He is doing this undeniably also because he is a father and he is concerned about his son. One can debate whether that is a proper exercise of the discretion vested in the president, but it's one at least that we can all understand and appreciate as this goes forward, anticipating once again that there will be more pardons, not only imposed and granted by this current president, but by Donald Trump as well. He has already indicated, Trump has, that when he becomes president, he will extend pardons to perhaps as many as 1,200 people already convicted, some of them in the process, for the assault, the insurrection on the Capitol on January 6th of 2001. And again, that is an authority that the president has. Certainly that would not be without controversy, as have many of these grants of pardons. But note once again that if that happens, all of those individuals, according to the Supreme Court, are also acknowledging that they have committed crimes. And that, of course, is the lesson of Burdick and the other cases the Supreme Court has issued when it describes the pardon authority generally. All of that leads up to our final story in this area, having to do with the word coming out of the White House about anticipated pardons and protective pardons. When Amicus Alara View comes back, we'll talk about that news story and why this discussion should lead to no further pardons of future pardons.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. As Democrats pick up the pieces from their loss to Donald Trump, one of the first major decisions the party will be making is to select the new chair of the Democratic National Committee. The race for that role now has a major Wisconsin connection. Ben Wickler, the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, is now officially running for DNC chair. One Democratic source I talked to characterized Wickler as a Goldilocks candidate for the role. He's liked by both centrists and progressives, big dollar donors and grassroots organizers, and knows how important state parties around the country can be in a second Trump term. So, could he be just right for the role? The vote for DNC chair is scheduled for February 1st. A lot can happen between now and then. But whether or not Wickler wins in his bid for the role, it will certainly be a story to watch for Democratic politics in Wisconsin.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Alara. My name is Jim Santel. I am the host of this, our first hour, and yes, our second hour of our weekend broadcast, concluding this hour with our broad and expansive discussion of pardons in America, prompted by the recent pardon by President Joe Biden of his son, Hunter Biden, anticipating more pardons coming out of this administration in the remaining days of it, and also pardons coming out of the incoming Trump administration. All of those likely in the future rule of law events of America. The other major story coming out late this past week is just this, that President Biden's staff, the current administration, may in fact be debating internally, discussing inside their own offices whether the president should issue blanket pardons for a swath, a whole group of people that President-elect Donald Trump has identified as his enemies, his rivals, to protect them from the retribution that Donald Trump has described will be a part of his term. He has threatened that retribution after he takes office, according to people not only inside his team, but according to Donald Trump, very overtly, very, very explicitly talked about going after his enemies, including the Bidens, including the Obamas and others. White House officials do not believe, according to the reporting, nor should they believe, that any of these potential recipients have actually committed crimes, and that's the point. But many of them, nonetheless, getting increasingly worried as Donald Trump's presidency arrives, that he may, in fact, seek to investigate and prosecute them. We have talked in the past about the considerable guardrails on actual prosecutions of individuals who have not committed crimes in America. And the principal guardrail there, of course, is the grand jury system. 23 people who are called together to determine whether or not
Evidence of crime has been presented to them that necessitates the return of a grand jury indictment. All of that is a safeguard. Nonetheless, an awful lot of people being concerned right now because they may be on his short list, a long list of people who might be in the view of Donald Trump. A lot of people concerned about that. Interestingly, on the Hill, Jim Clyburn, Representative Jim Clyburn, the former House whip, one of the president's closest allies, has urged the White House to consider these preemptive pardons basically to ensure that the individuals, even though they haven't committed crimes, might be protected from future action by a Trump administration. Clyburn went on to say, I think there are a lot of people who are coming into this next administration who are telling us who they are. I've seen Kash Patel saying who he's going to go after, and so why should we not believe them? And that's what I said to the president's staff. You've got to believe these people. I think it will be less than an honorable thing to do to leave this office, speaking about the presidency, again, this is Jim Clyburn, and not do what you can do to protect the integrity of their decision making, especially when they carry or they're carrying out these responsibilities as patriots to this country, doing the things that are necessary in pursuit of a more perfect union. So debate going on right now inside the White House about whether that should be done. And here is the commentary from me, and that is that this should not be done. This is a very bad idea, notwithstanding my great respect for not only our current president, but also for Jim Clyburn and others who are not wrong in being concerned about the future possibility that a Trump administration under a new Department of Justice, Pam Bondi and Kash Patel at the FBI, could indeed initiate investigations. And yes, indeed, preemptive pardons may have some impact in terms of shutting those down in some ways. Depends upon the specifics of what actually happens. But here's the reason why. Here's the reason why doing this would be inappropriate. And that is basically the reason that is implicit and explicit in the Supreme Court cases, that an acceptance by an individual of a pardon by a president is also an acknowledgement of guilt. And many people have said already, why am I accepting a pardon, when I have pled guilty? I have been found guilty of nothing. And more beyond that, I have not committed crimes. There's nothing that I have done, whether it's in a prosecution, whether it's fulfilling the particular policy objectives of this president, that could properly be characterized by any grand jury, by any legitimate prosecutor, by any legitimate attorney general or FBI director as a crime. And if I do accept a reprieve, if I do accept a pardon from a president, including this president, am I not acknowledging that I've committed crimes? And that's the argument against it. Don't do this, Mr. President. It is not a good policy issue. It's not a good precedent to set. Beyond that, you can do it. You've got the authority to do it. The Supreme Court has told us that. And yes, indeed, you would be providing some sense of protection for people, as Jim Clyburn says, who have served our government well. The downside of it is much greater, however. And that is not only sending the message somehow to that all the people who may accept these pardons have committed crimes in recent years. They have not. They have done their jobs as good civil servants. Among the people that have been identified, for example, among the so-called deep state enemies who Donald Trump and others inside a future Department of Justice include people in the former Republican administration of Donald Trump himself, Bill Barr, the former attorney general, Mark Esper, former defense secretary, Pat Cipollone, former White House counsel, former CIA director, Gina Haspel, Christopher Wray, the current FBI director. Those are just the people inside the former administration of Donald Trump who may show up on a list of people who might be prosecuted or persecuted through an investigation. Of course, there are many, many others in the current administration, including, for example, Jack Smith, who is the special counsel who has been the animating factor and the prosecutor behind those two federal cases. He and his staff, for example, might be on a list of people in this present administration who could be the subjects, according to what Donald Trump and perhaps others have said, who might be the subject of these investigations. The answer, of course, is they haven't committed crimes. And while these are very different times, and yes, indeed, we shouldn't have to engage in this kind of discussion, the reality is that a preemptive pardon as to Jack Smith, as to any of these other individuals inside the present administration, former members of this administration, former members of the Trump administration, all of that suggests that they are themselves, like Richard Nixon, who did commit crimes, that they themselves are somehow responsible for criminal conduct. That is not a message that you want to send to the people of the United States of America. Why? Because it's simply not true. They did not commit crimes, and therefore the pardon authority should not be extended to them. Even though by not doing that again, you run the risk, a risk that is legitimate based upon what the incoming president has said about what he may do. We'll talk more about pardons in the future as we continue here on Amicus, a Law Review. Stay with us for the second hour of our weekend broadcast.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for matinee on air.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Dr. Kristen Lierley, who will address all our health needs to make us more efficient TV watchers. Then Nightlight will really go up in smoke when I welcome Rose Bauman from Legacy Cigars.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8. The Todd Allbaugh Show.
Pat Kreitlow, all your time in the media, television, radio, what have you, what was one or two of the oddest things that people were complaining about?
As a TV anchor, your hair.
You have some of the finest hair around. How could anybody criticize your hair?
Oh, well, because a consultant forced me to change it.
Were there focus groups?
I'm not aware of any focus groups other than the audience, which universally hated it. It was a bowl haircut.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.